Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, Russia's Sputnik Radio, and Spanish National Radio. We'll begin with NHK World Radio Japan. In the Indian Ocean, a large oil spill is creating an environmental disaster on the coast of the island of Mauritius. More countries have ratified the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. 6 more ratifications are needed to bring the treaty into force. NHK Japan.
In Mauritius, a conservationist says the environment and economy will be hit hard after an estimated 1,000 tons of oil spilled from a Japanese cargo ship.
It takes decades, if not more, to restore the damage caused by an accident like this.
Vikash Tataya says the accident happened about 2 kilometers from a nature preserve that's been protecting birds and rare plants for over 35 years. He says protected mangrove wetlands were damaged by oil from the vessel named Wakashio. Contaminated soil will affect birds and insects over the long term. He says the economic fallout will be enormous as many in the region rely on fishing and tourism.
COVID would have affected us for a few months, but the Wakashio wreck will affect us for years to come.
Tataya said Mauritius wants compensation from the ship's operator. He called on Japan to help the environment recover from the damage. The Caribbean nation of St. Kitts and Nevis has become the 44th country to ratify the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. This means 6 more ratifications are needed to bring the treaty into force. The announcement was made on Sunday, the 75th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombing of the Japanese city of Nagasaki. The Foreign Minister of St. Kitts and Nevis, Mark Brantley, called the bombing of Nagasaki the apogee of human cruelty and inhumanity. He said his country sees no useful purpose for nuclear arms and called on all nations to work towards peace and mutual respect for mankind. This comes after Ireland, Nigeria, and the small island nation of Niue ratified the treaty on Thursday. In a message to a memorial ceremony in Nagasaki, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he looks forward to the treaty entering into force as an important new element of the international nuclear disarmament campaign. The treaty, adopted 3 years ago, prohibits the development, possession, and use of nuclear weapons. But nuclear powers, as well as Japan and other countries protected by the U.S. nuclear umbrella, have not signed it.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They are now heard from 9:30 to 10 p.m. at 5975-7245 and 11970, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi spoke with legendary journalist John Pilger. John talked about the ongoing persecution of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, new charges against him, efforts to extradite him to the United States, and the silence of mainstream journalists on his persecution. They then discuss rising tensions between the United States and its allies and China, the hypocrisy of Western foreign policy against Beijing, the Hong Kong national security law, the U.S. military encirclement of China, how the country is entering a state of siege, and rising tensions with Australia. Sputnik Radio.
With legendary filmmaker John Pilger. One truth teller who has exposed ideological privatization as well as war crimes, Julian Assange, who is currently in jail where there has been a death, Belmarsh Prison in London. What are we expecting from this next hearing for the world's most famous publisher and journalist, arguably?
You're quite right. There has been a death from COVID in Belmarsh, and there's been a lot more in Belmarsh that, of course, the authorities are not telling us about. What can we expect? Well, at the moment, it's farce. At the end of June, the so-called prosecution in this extradition bid by the United States stood up and said, well, they have a new indictment that overrides the 17 previous charges in the old indictment. The old charges were about espionage. But this is about hacking. Their major informant is a paid FBI informant, a serial criminal who has been convicted of forgery, theft, pedophilia, and I'm laughing because it's so black. He has been put up as the major informant in this new indictment. Now, there's a twist here. Having announced this new indictment at a press conference, the court hasn't heard anything. The defense hasn't heard anything. There's nothing in the system of due process about this new indictment. And let's hope it isn't a farce. Let's hope it is something that is rightly thrown out of court and gives Julian Assange his freedom at last. But there could be a coming farce in which the court considers one indictment. He's then extradited to the United States to face another indictment. This is not justice. The whole case has been a really black farce from beginning to end and should have not got past day one in February. And it's down to true justice to deal with this when it comes up again on 7th of September, this time in the Old Bailey. This is an opportunity, perhaps, for British justice to redeem just that much, because at the moment it's shame by the Assange case. Anybody who looks at it objectively, impartially, can't help but feel, yes, shame.
You know, there is an outcry, probably justifiable, arguably, from all journalists in NATO nations about the arrest of the British publisher Jimmy Lai in Hong Kong. Why is it that you think that the same journalists are not crying out for the release of Julian Assange? Do you think they don't recognize Assange as a publisher? They think of him as a whistleblower, and there's some confusion in the minds of journalists in NATO nations?
I think in recent years that journalists who might have otherwise behaved, at least professionally, have lost the knack and the skill of journalism and the will of journalism. I think it's gone. The spaces that were once there in the so-called mainstream media for those who could ask hard questions, who could challenge the system, have all but closed. Not entirely, but pretty well, all but closed. And journalism has given up. It's become something else. It's become an echo chamber of whatever propaganda is run through the system. It's propaganda against Assange, war with China, Russia to blame for the weather. Some of it is, as I say, almost laughable propaganda, but it is presented as news. Now, you ask me why that is so. I can't really answer to that. I do know that there's been a surrendering of what journalism was. And journalism is basically doing your best to keep the record straight. That's all. You don't get it right all the time, but doing your best to keep the record straight. That duty, and I would suggest it's a duty, has been abandoned.
Well, Boris Johnson, former journalist, he's not commenting on the Assange case. And as regards China, because, and the journalists here are reporting it, the gross human rights violations of China, Britain is sending its top warship, HMS Elizabeth, to the South China Sea. Why do you think that's a bad idea, given what we're hearing about China? Its crackdown on human rights in Hong Kong, its millions in concentration camps, and its attempts to use surveillance against all citizens.
Well, we need evidence for everything you've just said there, Afshin. And I think journalism is about evidence. It's about hard evidence. And throughout my career, I've had a duty imposed on me when I've reported from Asia, from Cambodia, Vietnam, Indo-Pakistan, the United States, to produce evidence. Evidence is no longer required. China may be doing ghastly things, but we never look in the mirror, do we? While we accuse China of subverting all these human rights, the fact that the United States has overthrown the government in Bolivia, sanctions have caused, according to a United Nations estimate, up to 100,000 deaths in Venezuela. The suffering, let alone the number of deaths around the world that has been caused by us, is never a subject for serious discussion. We have our enemies, we have our demons, and they're the ones. Hong Kong is the perfect one. I mean, it's interesting. The Chinese are bringing in a national security law, and it sounds pretty harsh, actually. But the other day, the president of the Law Council in this country, in Australia, said that actually the Chinese national security law wasn't as far-reaching as the new draconian laws that have been brought in this country. A democracy. What is going on in the world is a struggle for true freedom within democracies. Liberty has become privilege. Perhaps it always was, but it certainly is now. And the loss, the erosion of democracy is the big story. That's the big story that no one really wants to write. In Australia, these draconian foreign interference laws, as I mentioned, at least the equal of anything China can impose in Hong Kong. In the United States, both the presidential and other executive impositions, and we like this word these days, though we seldom use it about ourselves, impositions of forms of a totalitarianism. These are not a story. Trump is, because he's reviled for all sorts of reasons. All he is a caricature of a system. His predecessor, Barack Obama, who's much admired by many, was the one who put whistleblowers away, was the one who started seven wars, was the one who ordered the murder of people by drone. These are all in our so-called backyard. It's become almost a fetish. There are the two bad guys in the world. There's China. China wasn't a bad guy until a few years ago, actually. It was, most people's view of it was benign. Now it's a bad guy. Russia has always been a bad guy. But what is so dangerous about this misinformation, the fact that China is reported without people understanding this country is ringed by 400 US bases on its doorstep, and that China is almost certainly going into a form of a state of siege. I've seen this happen in other countries. That means it will defend itself, and it will defend itself with the most lethal weapons that it can fire. For instance, its development of maritime missiles that can destroy whole fleets, the change from low alert to high alert in its nuclear posture. None of these are real news, or if they are, they're put in the context of bad China. But what is the cause of them? China has, as far as I can see, for all its faults, and there are many, of course, China wants to get on making business and making things in the world. What's going on here, of course, is that China once again, and this has happened before in history, China once again is challenging the very notion of Western and white superiority. And that is unacceptable.
Well, not only is there evidence of Chinese war crimes, it's being spread across the media here all the time. But since you mentioned Australia, Scott Morrison, your Prime Minister, said, actually, it's no longer inconceivable. It's no longer inconceivable that there is a hot war between China and the West, whatever that is. That in this 75th year anniversary of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. What did you make of what Scott Morrison said? Do you think that he's showing us what some leaders in NATO nations are thinking?
I don't take a lot of notice of what Morrison says, to be frank with you, because Morrison is an echo of the US. At the height of the pandemic, Morrison announced $270 billion worth of arms for perhaps the most secure country, secure politically, secure strategically, secure geographically on Earth, Australia. And the centerpiece of this new wonder arsenal will be missiles that will be able to reach China. China is Australia's biggest trading partner. Unravel that if you can.
John Pilger, thank you.
That interview with John Pilger was by Afshin Ratansi on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all of the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help support my efforts like a listener to WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana did this week. We will conclude with Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Allison Hughes reports on Bolivia. Self-appointed President Jeanine Añez has sent the military to suppress major labor unions and indigenous associations, peasants and urban workers who have united in a general strike. They have begun to block highways in protest against the third postponement of elections. Añez and the members of her cabinet speak of a potential civil war less than 1 year after the disputed elections of 2019 resulted in a coup that forced President Evo Morales into exile. Morales is calling on his followers to accept the latest date for elections, but also to demand that the date be fixed and unchangeable. Spanish National Radio.
To Bolivia, where the government of self-appointed President Jeanine Añez has mobilized the military against protesters who have blocked highways for the past 8 days after promised elections were postponed a third time. Bolivian trade unions, associations of indigenous groups, and members of the Movement for Socialism, former President Evo Morales' party, have been protesting the TSE, Supreme Electoral Tribunal's decision to schedule the first round of elections on October 18th, after the initial dates set for May and September were cancelled. The government justified the postponements because of the COVID-19 pandemic that is currently spreading unchecked throughout Latin America and the United States. The leading Bolivian trade union, the COB, and its indigenous allies contend that the coup-installed government of Jeanine Áñez has no intention of holding elections as long as the leftist opposition party, the MAS, is leading in the polls, as it is currently. A newly unified mass of rural campesinos or peasants, miners, and urban workers under COB leadership staged a general strike on August 3rd and began the indefinite protests. The government has blamed the crisis in Bolivia's hospitals on those protests. On Monday, August 10th, the government spokesman Arturo Murillo told the Spanish language CNN host Fernando, quote, "We're trying to prevent a civil war in this country and we have only a few hours left, Fernando, I guarantee you. After this, if tomorrow this issue isn't resolved, well, because we're negotiating to have all the blockades lifted. If this occurs, if all the people who have incited these actions are identified, they'll have to pay for the crimes against humanity or for war crimes. They'll have to pay justice at some point. Right now, we're trying to save lives on the one hand and trying to prevent more deaths overall." On Tuesday, from exile in Argentina, Evo Morales called on the demonstrators to consider the TSE proposal to hold elections on October 18th. In a communication, the former president recommended the trade unions and associations accept that date as long as it is, he wrote, by law, the definitive, unmovable, non-postponable date of elections. The demonstrations mobilized by the COB, Bolivian Workers Central Union, and the Pact of Unity that brings together peasant trade unions and indigenous groups have cut major highways after two failed attempts at dialogue over the weekend. Blockading the roads with tires, boulders, and rubble, protesters have cut traffic in strategic spots connecting central Cochabamba with Santa Cruz, Bolivia's biggest city and financial capital, and La Paz, the capital. The government claims that the protesters have prevented trucks carrying medical supplies and oxygen and even food from reaching the hospitals where they are desperately needed. For their part, demonstrators insist that all medical material and humanitarian aid has been allowed through the blockades. Current political crisis in Bolivia first exploded last October 20th when the conservative opposition denounced electoral fraud in elections that saw incumbent President Evo Morales winning. The U.S.-led Organization of American States confirmed that it detected irregularities that were later found not to exist. Opposition protesters on the streets clashed with Morales supporters, prompting the military to invite Evo Morales to leave. On November 10th, he stepped down and flew to Mexico and later to Argentina. Continuing protests with his followers demonstrating were violently crushed by police and right-wing squads, leaving more than 30 people dead. Jeanine Áñez proclaimed herself president in the midst of the power vacuum and promised swift new elections, which have yet to be held. Her first decisions referred to foreign policy, reversing membership in left-leaning Latin American alliances, recognizing the U.S. promoted Venezuelan opposition leader as that country's president, and supporting the re-election of OAS leader Luis Almagro. The United States was among the first to recognize the new government in Bolivia. Áñez also pressed charges against Evo Morales and members of his government and party. While the economic reforms Evo Morales put into place during the 14 years he headed the country raised millions of Bolivians out of poverty, Bolivia is still the poorest country in Latin America. In the midst of the COVID pandemic, most Bolivians are unable to shelter in place or quarantine and continue to work in the irregular economy. At the same time, the indigenous middle class that arose during the Morales presidency as a result of his policies are now finding their standard of living falling fast, and even indigenous university graduates are losing the social rights won over the past decade as a result of the new government's shock neoliberal reforms. As analyst Anton Fleig notes, the incapacity of Agnes's government to deal with the terrible economic situation and crisis is strengthening social movements and the COB, while the racism of the government is bringing middle-class indigenous people back into the mass fold. And he continues, during more than 100 days of quarantine, the government failed to provide respirators and inform the indigenous-speaking population about the dangerous pandemic, instead referring to closed-down indigenous radio stations. So it didn't take long for the health system to collapse. Since then, people have been dying on the street in the thousands in a country of just 11 million. At the same time, the economic situation has worsened drastically. In the 13 years of mass rule, Bolivia regularly posted the strongest economic growth in Latin America. This took place under Economy Minister Luis Arce, who is now the mass presidential candidate. In just over a decade, extreme poverty fell by more than a half, from 38.2% in 2005 to 15.2% in 2018. Moderate poverty also decreased from 60.6% in 2005 to 34.6% in 2018. In this sense, under Evo Morales and Luis Arce, Bolivia had a golden decade. The poor indigenous population working in the informal economy benefited most from all of this. Natural gas was nationalized, making possible mass-scale investments. Social security and benefit payments for elderly people, mothers, parents, and others were created. A huge infrastructure of schools, universities, hospitals, and public transport were built, including modern projects like the urban cable cars connecting La Paz and El Alto. A new generation of indigenous working-class teenagers entered universities for the first time. In the last year, the mass government had sufficient financial resources to start creating a universal health care system to make health care a human right. They implemented their own social communitarian economic model, making Bolivia a truly independent country, he writes. But more than half of the workforce still depends directly or indirectly on a day-to-day work in the informal sector. And after more than 100 days of quarantine without any social policies to alleviate their suffering, this sector is now under intense pressure. Parts of the new indigenous middle class are now losing everything they had, and poor people are hungry, despite neighborhood initiatives like Common Pots and the People Will Save Themselves. This terrible situation is the base of the coming social conflicts.
Those reports by Allison Hughes were from Radio Exterior de España or Spanish National Radio. Spain may be heard at their website rtve.es and by podcast as REE. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. You could listen to a podcast about the history of the shortwave report, this program, on a program called Humboldt Lighthouse. The shortwave report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The shortwave report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.